We are currently digging into this concept of the third temple, something that I'm going to tell you, I believe this is more relevant for today than ever before, especially in light of what we see happening in Jerusalem. The Jews are moving to rebuild the third temple. There's no question about it. And you ask yourself, is this relevant? Is this prophetically significant, what they're actually moving to do? And I can answer that with a resounding absolutely. You better believe this is significant. The prophetic implications can't even be measured. It is that intense. However, what do we do with that? What do we do with that reality in light of what we studied in our last message, which if you remember, there are things that we learned about the third temple that are immovable. Things that cannot be altered, cannot be changed, such as only the Mashiach builds the temple. Think about that. Only the Mashiach builds the temple. The prophets are very clear on that. We learned about the fact that the third temple, it's not earthly, it is in fact heavenly. It's not temporary, it's eternal. So you think about this reality of what we have. And so you take that information, you juxtaposition what is happening in Jerusalem today, and what do you do? How are we supposed to understand this on a prophetic level? And as I said before, there's only one answer to that. You can only understand this through the lens of the new covenant. You can only understand this through the lens of Yeshua. See, because if you don't have Yeshua, you don't have the Spirit of God. And according to the Apostle Paul, only the Spirit of God knows the things of God. So that we can't know the things of God unless we have that Spirit. We can't have that Spirit unless we have Yeshua. This is a reality. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to peel back more layers to understand this and get some real perspective on what's going on. And we are living in amazing days, I can tell you that. And hopefully, just even on a little bit, at least at a slight level, you'll appreciate it more at the end of this message. What we are going to do today is we are going to actually take a look at history. We're going to dig into history. And maybe for some of you, your situation is you absolutely, you know, whether, you know, maybe not so much in undergraduate or graduate school, but, you know, you get into elementary, junior high, you start to learn about history. And for some of you, it's a snooze fest. I mean, you want nothing to do with it. You do not want to fall asleep in today's message. This is where I'm going with this. You want to stay awake for this because there are such critical points that we're going to be covering. You need to be alert. You need to be able to digest this stuff and pack it away. With that said, I want to take you back to the second century, early second century. We have Emperor Hadrian. He's emperor at this time, and it's important to understand something about his reign. At the front end of his reign, Emperor Hadrian's relationship with the Jewish people is amazing, or at the very least, favorable. And why do I say that? Do you know that he actually granted permission for the Jews to rebuild the third temple? Amazing. He grants them that permission, but then something happened that today has mystified historians. Mystified them. They didn't even know how it happened, where a light switch got flicked off. Something happened to where his heart towards the Jewish people completely radically changed into a 180, where he started walking in the footsteps of Antiochus Epiphanes. Remember Antiochus? The very one that the book of Daniel identifies as an antichrist? The one who, interestingly enough, came in, as the Jews perceived, peaceably at the front end, only to find out all hell would be unleashed. He started a war against the Torah. He made war against Shabbat. He made war against circumcision. He made war against the dietary laws. Everything in the Torah that by which a Jew would identify with, by which God was called them to be. It's to be their identity of who they are. All these righteous commandments, they were all under assault by the spirit of Antichrist, by Antiochus Epiphanes. What I'm going to tell you right now, if you hold Hadrian up side by side with Antiochus, you can't tell the difference. They're literally a mere reflection of one another. Hadrian starts out, it seems to be peaceable, but then something happens. The spirit of Antichrist enters him, and guess what he does? He wages a war against the Torah. He wages a war against Shabbat, not allowing them to study it. Wages a war against circumcision, against the period laws. He comes against all of these things. Well, what do you think is going to happen when you do that? Well, just go back in history to discover that. You look at what happened to Antiochus as he waged a war against the Torah, against the Jewish people. He wants war. It is war he is going to get. Because at that time, a man by Mattathias rises up and revolts. And his son carries out the revolt, who we now know as Judah Maccabee. And Judah fights the wars of the Lord and actually destroys the Seleucid army, takes back Jerusalem, takes back the Temple Mount, and purifies it. Well, here's what's interesting. That's exactly how this story goes. Because a man comes on a scene known as Shimon Bar Kokhba. He comes on the scene and he leads a Jewish revolt. Now, there's a few things about him that you need to understand. Number one, the rabbis record that this guy had a magnetic personality. Talented, gifted, an unbelievable leader. People were attracted to him. He's charismatic. He had all of this going for him. Even traditions got a little wild saying he could just rip out a tree, roots and all, out of the ground. I mean, just amazing things that are said about him. But this guy led an army that wasn't a normal army. And this is significant for today, so listen to me carefully. His army wasn't a bunch of barbarians. His army wasn't secular Jews. They were religious. And we know this from those letters at Nahal Hever near the Dead Sea. We know they were religious. This was more of a zealot movement. Religious Jews following. So think of it in the mindset of currently where we're at, Orthodox Jews. These were men who had religious convictions. They followed Bar Kokhba. Now, it gets even greater than this in this whole, if we go back into this historical context. The rabbis favored him. The rabbis adored him, specifically one in mind, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, one of the most notable rabbis that have ever existed in Judaism, he declared Bar Kokhba to be the Messiah. He's HaMashiach. He is the one. He is the Messiah. And the people bought it. He believed it. Now, why in the world would they believe that? What would happen? How could they come to that conclusion? What was the one of the primary things that the Jewish people are waiting for in regard to Mashiach ben David? He is going to fight the wars of the Lord, and he will conquer. And here you have the situation. You have the spirit of Antichrist moving, clearly going against Torah, all the principles of Torah, everything by which Jews identify with, right? He's coming against this, and Bar Kokhba goes in and literally routs the Roman Empire. Not the whole Roman Empire, but out of Judea, out of the land of Jerusalem. He purges them. An unthinkable victory. It was supernatural. What Bar Kokhba did was absolutely seen as the greatest wonder. That clearly God must be one. He won this victory. He's the Mashiach. He's the Messiah. Now you think about that. Put yourself in there and seeing that. Being up against impossible odds and yet being victorious. So he takes Jerusalem. He takes the Temple Mount. What is left? What is left for the Messiah to accomplish? If you're the Messiah, what are you expected to do? Rebuild the temple. Now keep in mind, Bar Kokhba has possession of Yerushalayim. He has it. And guess what he does? He proclaims, it's time. We're going to rebuild it. But here's where things get interesting. Does that happen? Actually, Rome amasses an army that is unprecedented against Bar Kokhba. In fact, the emperor was so terrified by how great of an army that he had that he set an unprecedented half of Rome's army after him. And you put this into perspective. When Rome destroyed Jerusalem the first time, and according to Josephus, over 1 million Jews died. When he sent in the Roman Empire, he sent in, it's estimated, 4 legions. He sends 3 times that amount after Bar Kokhba to Jerusalem Just to give you a little comparison of how trembling, how awesome this whole conquest was of Bar Kokhba. The unthinkable, in their minds, accomplishing miraculousness, if you will. And you have all his followers looking, hailing him as Mashiach. And now we're going to build the temple. Before that can ever happen, Rome comes in and literally routs, decimates Bar Kokhba and the armies. Incredible. It was a bloodbath. Horrifying. In fact, I want to share with you a little bit of history here. And when Bar Kokhba falls, this is just as a side note. He falls in Betar on the 9th of Av. So get this. The first temple by the Babylonians falls on the 9th of Av. The second temple by the Romans when they came in falls on the 9th of Av. Here you have Bar Kokhba going to build the third temple, and he falls on the 9th of Av. Now, to further put this in perspective, the Roman historian Dio Cassius, now keep in mind what we're about to read. This is not Jewish commentary. This is not biblical commentary. This is Roman commentary, okay? The Roman historian, he says this, 580,000 men were slain in the various raids and battles. Make no mistake, he's talking about the Jews. And the number of those that perished by famine, disease, and fire was past finding out. Thus, nearly the whole of Judea was made desolate. The whole of Judea. Now, you think about that, 580,000, and then an incalculable amount beyond that. So we could safely say, we could estimate, it might be the numbers that we would have heard happened in 70 AD by Josephus. Over 1 million Jews have perished. Think about that. That's incredible. And then he goes on to say this, a result of which the people had had forewarning before the war. Now, this isn't a Jewish commentator looking in hindsight 20. This is a Roman commentator saying there were signs. There were signs that calamity was coming. And they didn't see him. Why? The veil. The veil was over their eyes. Do you know what they called Bar Kokhba before it was all said and done? Bar Koziva. What? Why did they call him that? It means son of a lie. Son of a lie. They recognized he was a false Messiah. We just followed a false Messiah. One of the greatest tragedies in Jewish history happened because they believed he was the Mashiach. I wonder if these Jews would have believed in Yeshua. And we know these were Orthodox in the mindset. These are not Messianic Jews. I wonder, had they listened to Yeshua, how different that outcome would have been. Because this is what Yeshua says. Look at what he says. Oh, we're not. Hold on a second. I want to back up. I'm jumping ahead here. I want to finish something here in regard to Dio Cassius, and then I'll show you what Yeshua says. As Dio Cassius goes on, he gets into the forewarnings that they had had, and this is what he says: for the tomb of Solomon, which the Jews regard as an object of veneration. That's important. An object of veneration. You're going to need to shelf that. We're going to come back to this. What happened to it? It fell to pieces of itself and collapsed, and many wolves and hyenas rushed howling into their cities. And so this whole concept of what I talk about, that they're following this false Messiah, they have this veil down. Even Roman historians are looking and saying they were so blind, there were signs, evidence signs that were clear. The very objects that you adored are falling. They're crumbling. And hyenas and jackals running around howling. Did you not see that this portended, that this was the foreshadow of calamity? You didn't see this. And so this is something that you need to see, that you need to put on the shelf, because as we continue, this is going to become extremely relevant to where we're at today. And so now going back to that concept, I want to take you to what Yeshua says. He gives this warning. And this is Matthew 24, verse 5. For many will come in my name saying, Ani HaMashiach, I am the Messiah, and will deceive many. And so you look at Bar Kokhba's revolt and all his amazing, his glorious army, all these religious Jews following him, wanting this, who didn't listen to Yeshua, whose fathers didn't listen to Yeshua. They couldn't see that he was a false Messiah. Yeshua goes on in verse 23, "Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There,' do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect." See, I have told you beforehand. Put yourself in the historical context where you're suffering at the hands of Hadrian. There's no question he has the spirit of Antichrist. A great Jewish leader rises up who everyone reveres, that even the religious leaders are calling this, who? HaMashiach. He's the Messiah. He's the Messiah. And then he fights the wars of the Lord and he accomplishes the impossible, being victorious over Rome. It's unthinkable. See, but if they had backed up, if they had listened to Yeshua, as soon as Bar Kokhba was starting to be hailed as the Messiah, that's when you say, I'm getting off this train. I'm done. Because Yeshua warned me, this cannot be. You're not the Messiah. There's only one. Now, it goes on and says in verse 26, "Therefore, if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the desert,' do not go out. 'Look, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be." In other words, what Yeshua says, he says, you don't have to look to your neighbor. No one's going to question whether or not the Messiah has come, because the entire world, Jew and Gentile, will see him coming on the clouds of heaven. Everyone will be clear on that matter. Revelation 1 says, every eye will see him. There's no doubt. There's no mystery. So if someone's trying to tell you he's the Messiah, or and Yeshua says, beware of false messiahs and false prophets. I mean, that's where you get really into scary territory. And so as we look at this Bar Kokhba event, what I want you to take away in regard to this story is this, and this is critical. Prior to calamity coming upon them, two notable things happen. Number one, there was a move to rebuild the third temple. And number two, there were signs. There were signs confirming the calamity. Keep that. Now with that, we're going to move up a couple hundred years. And we come to Julian, the apostate. And he was called the apostate because, you know, keep in mind, when Constantine the Great, who by the way, is his uncle, Constantine the Great is his uncle. Well, he doesn't walk in the footsteps of his uncle. His uncle incorporated Christianity in Rome. This really is when you have the birth of the Holy Roman Empire. Constantine declared a Christian, baptized, all that. You know the story. And whether or not you agree with his theology, that's a different matter. The point being is Christianity, Christians, those who called upon the name of Jesus, they had never experienced a time of peace from the time Yeshua came to the time of until Constantine showed up. It was horrific persecution. Christians were getting tore up in the Colosseum as sport. There was no peace for them until Constantine comes on the scene. He incorporates Christianity, really. It's a political religious system now. It's an interesting turn of events. It's huge. But then later, you have Julian the Apostate come on. He's not favorable towards Christianity. In fact, he loves nothing more than to dismantle it. He wants to dismantle Christianity. He starts rebuilding the pagan temples. He starts encouraging the masses of Romans to worship anyone but the God of the Christians. Now, here's what's fascinating about this. The frosting on his cake, if you will, to give Christianity the ultimate black eye, he tells the Jews that, hey, we need to rebuild the third temple. We want this. He orders the rebuilding of the third temple. Now, here's what's amazing. Unlike Bar Kokhba, even earlier when Hadrian was favorable, he opens a door. The door is closed. Then Bar Kokhba takes Jerusalem, has the Temple Mount. It's going to rebuild it. Door closed again. Well, this is very different. They broke ground. When Julian orders the temple rebuilt, they are breaking ground. But here's what's amazing. Then all of a sudden, something happened. And fortunately for us, this something is recorded. And it's not recorded in your Bibles, and it's not recorded by Christians or by Jews and rabbis. You don't find that. It's a Roman historian. And so as we look at this, I want to invite you to see this Ammianus Marcellinus, or Marcellinus is how you would say it. He is actually a personal friend of Julian. And what he's going to do, he's going to give an account of what happened as they're building the third temple. And pay close attention. Julian thought to rebuild at an extravagant expense the proud temple once at Jerusalem, and committed this task to Alypius of Antioch. Alypius set vigorously to work and was seconded by the governor of the province when fearful balls of fire breaking out near the foundations continued their attacks till the workmen, after repeated scorchings, could approach no more. He gave up the attempt. This is not Christian history. This is not a Christian recordation. This is not Jewish recordation. This is literally what Julian's friend records literally happens. Absolutely insane. Think about this. Think about, and you know, historians have come on, you know, post and attempted to say, well, this must be the result of the great Galilean earthquake of 363. You know, here's the deal. I don't care what you call it. When you set foot on the Temple Mount to rebuild the third temple and fire starts shooting out of the ground, you have divine intervention. Period. Now, this is an amazing thing, is it not? So now we have to ask the question, could there be a force prohibiting the rebuilding of the third temple? Could there be? You have to at least at this point ask the question. Well, let's fast forward in time a little bit. We come to 614 AD to the Sassanian Empire, the Persian Empire. In 614, guess what? The Persians, they go up, they drive out the Christian Byzantines. They drive them out of Jerusalem. They take Jerusalem. They take the Temple Mount. Now, here's what's interesting about this is they do it with the help of the Jews. Thousands upon thousands of Jews had joined with them to purge out. And obviously, the Jews have a vested interest. This is their city given to them by Hashem, by the living God, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It makes sense. You can see why they want their land back. They want what is rightfully given to them. Well, as a token of his appreciation, guess what? A door opens again. The Persian emperor, he says, I'm going to allow you to rebuild the temple. Amazingly, relationships break down before it can ever come to fruition, and it never happens. Never happens. So we have door opening, door closing, door opening, door closing, door opening, door closing. It absolutely makes no sense. You start to compile this evidence, it's nuts. Let me fast forward to a more recent time. Here we have, go to 1967, the month of June, what we call the Six-Day War. I'm going to tell you something. Something happened here that if it were not so recent and if it were not recorded, no one would believe it. In fact, there's nothing in this narrative that makes any sense whatsoever. So what happens here in June, the month of June in 1967, Israel goes to the old city. They invade the old city of Jerusalem. They take the Temple Mount. And this is led by the commander, Mordechai Gur. And literally to this day, his words ring out. What he does is once he gets to the Temple Mount and takes it, he radios headquarters with these words. The Temple Mount is in our hands. 1967. Now put yourself as a Jew to have your feet on the Temple Mount or at headquarters and to literally hear Gur radio over, the Temple Mount is in our hands. Can you even imagine the overwhelming emotion that and the tie and the connection as a Jew, as the chosen people of God, you would have with your fathers and their fathers and their fathers? Your entire identity is wrapped around this right here, Jerusalem. This is where Abraham sacrificed Yitzhak. I mean, so powerful, overwhelm, emotion. So at this point, the brigade's chief communications officer, Ezra Arney, he comes to Gur and he says, shall we hoist the flag? The flag of Israel. Where? Where do you think he hoist? From the Dome of the Rock. You know what Gur says? Go up. Hoist the flag. I mean, this is an amazing thing. So this Ezra goes up, and he goes up with Achman, another gentleman. They go up, and they literally hoist the flag on the top of the Dome of the Rock. It is flying on the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount is theirs, total control, total possession. Absolutely amazing. What do you think would come after this? Because the rabbis are celebrating, the shofars are blowing on the Temple Mount. What do you think comes after the rebuilding of their temple? You better believe it. This is what comes. But here's the thing. Before that ever comes to fruition, the defense minister, Moshe Dayan, he's looking on at what's going on, that they hoisted the Israel flag. He's looking through binoculars, and he radios over to Gur, and he says this: do you want to set the Middle East on fire? Obviously, are you insane? What are you doing? At which point, Gur turns to Achman, and he actually tells him, get the flag, take it down. And it's so painful, the thought of it. He could not even do it. He had to commission it for someone else to do it. See, because the second they took that flag down, what did they do? They conceded the Temple Mount and any hope to rebuild a third temple. Now, I'm going to tell you, you cannot make this stuff up. One moment, they're crying out, the Temple Mount is in our hands. And it was like grasping water. Water going through their hands. The next moment, it's gone. The door was open. They had all power, all authority, and they literally handed it back. If this does not baffle your mind, this is as crazy, if not more crazy, than balls of fire shooting out of the ground. It makes no sense whatsoever. In fact, today rabbis are puzzled. They're in anguish. They're in pain that such a thing would be done. But it was. And then again, you have to ask, could it be that as we look at all these examples in history, that there's actually divine intervention? Let me ask you a question. Were the prophets right? Were the prophets true when they prophesied that the Mashiach will build the third temple? Was Yeshua right? Is Yeshua a true prophet? These are things that we are confronted with. Do you remember what Yeshua said to the Samaritan woman at the well? This is what she said, or this is what's recorded. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and this is the Samaritan talking to Yeshua, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. And Yeshua said, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain, meaning Gerizim, nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. Now, here's what's fascinating about this. He's like, this isn't going to be, and this is a direct statement in regard to the temple, because that's the place of worship. He's making a statement, and you can read the entire book of John, and you will not find anywhere that Yeshua somehow circles back and said, oh, but then, you know, after three generations, then it will be rebuilt. He doesn't say anything like that in regard to this age, the age of Esau. Everything looks as that is it. When he speaks it, it's going to happen, and nothing's going to change it. Let me take this a step further. This is not the only place he speaks of it. In Matthew 23, we read this. Oh, Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house, your Beit HaMikdash, is left to you desolate. It's desolate. Now, I got to say something here. And for those of you, and everybody has their experience in Israel. When you go to Israel, everybody has a little something different. But one thing I think for the most part, it's very emotional. We're all emotional. You go there, you will experience emotions you could not have premeditated. And I mean overwhelming. It is really an awesome thing. When my feet hit the Temple Mount, I was so excited because I was going to the place of the Beit HaMikdash. And when I got up there, I'm going to tell you, I've never felt such pain, such horror in my life. Literally, it was my heart sank down into my stomach. I couldn't even explain it. And there was one word that kept resounding as I'm walking on the Temple Mount, and that is desolation, desolation, desolation. You can feel it. They have unclean animals running about on the Temple Mount. Cats, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, cats? I mean, they were everywhere. They were coming around, crawling around. It was creepy. Absolutely creepy. And Yeshua says, your house is left to you desolate. Now listen, because he gives a timing. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. In other words, what Yeshua is saying is it's not going to change. The status quo will not change until you invite me back. That is when it's going to change. And that invitation, now here's the thing. This is a statement. This is a coronation of the king. It's a coronation. We read about it in Matthew 21. It was the first time Yeshua was coronated. They yelled, as they're laying palm branches, the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, as Yeshua comes riding, just as the prophets foretold in Zechariah 9:9, behold, your king comes to you riding lowly and on a donkey. And as this king's coming in, they're crying out, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. It's the declaration, it's anointing of the king. They're anointing him, they're calling him. It's a coronation, it's unbelievable. It's going to happen again. There are two coronations for Yeshua. Now, there's a precedent for this, because when you go back and read about Solomon, one of the most unique things about King Solomon was he was coronated twice. He was anointed twice as king. The Mashiach ben David would stand to reason that he, as the anointed son of David, would be a foreshadow of the anointed son of David. Absolutely amazing, mind-blowing. And so this, he gives us a time that it's going to be totally desolate. Now, I want to take this even a step further. You know, as we look back in history, and specifically, I want to bring Bar Kokhba back to the table. Again, I say, as Bar Kokhba goes to rebuild the temple, he goes to do this. There were signs at the same time that this was taking place that were happening, and all of it was a harbinger. Together, this was a harbinger portending that calamity was coming, okay? Well, I'm gonna draw your attention to what's going on in Israel. Just a couple things. There's many, many other things we could talk about, but just some things that really will resonate with you today. Number one, what do we see happening in Israel? There are all sorts of earthquakes that are happening. You wanna be in tune with this. That is very significant. Yeshua prophesied this would happen. But this earthquake, this one that hit the Sea of Galilee, this was felt in Jerusalem. I mean, it's quaking. And then so much so, you have an earthquake in northern Israel, felt like a bomb went off. I mean, it's moving. It's quaking. Things are happening. I want to show you another sign. And I want to just kind of set this up. Remember what Dio Cassius said. As he's saying, you know, the Jews during Bar Kokhba revolt, they had signs calamity was coming, but they didn't read them right. One of those signs is that the place of veneration began to crumble. I want to show you just a video clip here. This is last year. The Western Wall, a place of veneration, the highest place of veneration. This is a woman. Look at the size of that stone. It's over 200 pounds. Let me get this straight. If you lay stone, if you know anything about stone, and you set stone on another, stones don't just fall out. 220-pound stones don't come out of the Western Wall. But this is happening. This is happening right now. I want you to think about this. Literally crumbling right before. Do you think this is a sign? Absolutely. Let me show you another sign. This is the Temple Mount last year. That is a snake. Watch as they pan out from this. This is absolutely crazy. And what's so amazing is the pigeon, which is an animal that you would sacrifice. You saw that originally. Flies off because of the snake. Flies off because of the snake. And here's the snake. Nobody knows how he got it. It's bananas. But it's at the Western Wall, the highest place of veneration in Judaism. Two unbelievable signs in 1 year. Not including the little earthquakes that are happening right now. Not including other signs that we could talk about, and actually we'll get into next week. This is real. This is happening. Now I want to show you some commentary on this. On the snake. There was an article written, there was many articles, I'll just read you one. How symbolic that this snake should appear at the place that is at the heart of the Jewish people. Here so many Jews were killed. At a time when Jews are still being killed, we have received a symbolic warning from these holy stones. See, it's time to lift the veil. You better start looking at the events and the things through the lens of the new covenant, through the lens of Yeshua. And yes, all eyes should be on Jerusalem. That is the epicenter of prophecy. We need to be watching her. Now it goes on and actually says this. The Zohar, the basis of Jewish mysticism, and let's be clear, I'm not advocating for that at all, explained that the evil inclination personified by the snake in Eden will make a resurgence in the days before Mashiach, tempted to come and drink sustenance from the enormous levels of holiness that will appear in the world in the end of days. And then says this, it was noted in Sod 1820, and that's just a Kabbalistic site, that the snake appeared in the woman's prayer section, emphasizing its relevance to women. In Genesis, it is described how Eve was tempted into sin by the snake. In other words, the reason I showed you this is for this last statement. When that stone fell, it fell, when that snake was found, it was found in the section of women. Now, you go back to Genesis, we know the whole story. It is the serpent that came in and deceived the woman. Now, if you think this is all a coincidence, and the epicenter of the heritage of the Jewish people at the place that is more venerated than any other place on planet Earth for the Jewish people, you're kidding. That is not possible. These things are significant. We are living at the very end. Do you understand how close we are? Let me read to you some commentary from Josephus. Now remember, Josephus was a historian in the first century. And he comments upon that the fact that his people were blind to what was coming. There were signs of calamity that were on the way and they didn't read them. There was a veil. Listen to what he says. This is amazing. If I can get it. Okay. Thus, were the miserable people persuaded by these deceivers? In other words, Josephus saying false prophets had gone out and they were deceiving the people, of their own people though. And such as belied God himself while they did not attend nor give credit to the signs that were so evident and did so plainly foretell their future desolation, both like men infatuated without either eyes to see or minds to consider, they did not regard the denunciations that God made to them. Thus, there was a star resembling a sword, which stood over the city, and a comet that continued a whole year. This happened before the destruction of the Jerusalem in 70 AD. Amazing. Goes on. Thus also, before the Jews' rebellion and before those commotions which preceded the war, when the people were come in great crowds to the Feast of Unleavened Bread on the eighth day of the month of Xanthicus, meaning Nisan, at the ninth hour of the night, so great a light shone around the altar and the holy house that it appeared to be bright daytime, which lasted for a half an hour. We go on. The light seemed to be a good sign to the unskillful, but it was so interpreted by the sacred scribes as to portend those events that followed immediately upon it. At the same festival also, a heifer, as she was led by the high priest to be sacrificed, brought forth a lamb in the midst of the temple. Absolutely bonkers. Things go on before calamity is coming. The Lord sends obscure and bizarre signs. Moving on. Moreover, the eastern gate of the inner court of the temple, which was of brass and vastly heavy, had been with difficulty shut by 20 men and rested upon a basis armed with iron and had its bolts fastened very deep into the firm floor, which was there made of one entire stone, was seen to be opened of its own accord about the sixth hour of the night. Now, those that kept watch in the temple came hereupon running to the captain of the temple and told him of it, who then came up thither and not without great difficulty was able to shut the gate again. You're talking about unbelievable doors that just don't open. They can't open by themselves. They're just being found open. And this was also recorded in Yoma 39. We went through that. Now, continuing on. This also appeared to the vulgar to be a very happy prodigy, as if God did thereby open them the gate of happiness. But the men of learning understood it, that the security of their holy house was dissolved of its own accord, and that the gate was opened for the advantage of their enemies. So these publicly declared that the signal followed the desolation that was coming upon them. Besides these, a few days after that feast, on the 1 20th day of the month of Artemisius, which is ER, the second month in the Jewish calendar, a certain prodigious, an incredible phenomenon appeared. I suppose the account of it would seem to be a fable were it not related by those who saw it, and were the events that followed it of so considerable a nature as to deserve such signals. For before sunsetting, chariots and troops of soldiers and their armor were seen running about among the clouds and surrounding the cities. Now, it was signed, and I show you this for a reason. Prior to calamity, there are crazy signs that the Lord starts sending, like stones falling out of the western wall and snakes, which is the very symbol of Hasatan, showing up at the western wall. Oh, in the women's section. I mean, this is crazy. This is absurd. This is the kinds of things that we would expect to happen. And as you look in history, one of the things that we see over and over again that would portend, that would foretell that calamity is coming, is the move to rebuild the third temple. So now I ask you, what do you do with this? How are we supposed to look at? There's a serious move to rebuild the third temple. There are some serious signs that are taking place. How are we supposed to understand this? Well, let me take you to Zechariah 14. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations to battle against what? Against Jerusalem. It's going to come under great pressure. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished. Half of the city shall go into captivity. I cannot bring this scripture forward enough, because we are at the precipice of this being fulfilled. I already told you about the UN creating resolutions to divide Jerusalem. This is no mystery. This is no mystery. Well, now, as they start investigating Trump's peace plan, it's interesting. People have taken, and they're starting to comment to the people that are investigating this, and they're saying Trump's peace plan also includes a division of Jerusalem. We are living in crazy times. And there is going to be a time of Jacob's trouble. There is calamity coming in front of us. The fact that the Jews are moving to rebuild the third temple, it's not Messianic Jews, it's the Orthodox. The time that they're doing this right now and all these signs are starting to come out, you better wake up. Because we're at the very end. You know, this prophecy invites the coming. Because what happens when you divide half of the city, when you go back to, and here's the thing, you go back to pre-1967 borders, which you'd have split Jerusalem. Netanyahu has already come out and said, and I've shared this before, that if Israel is forced to go back to pre-1967 borders, she cannot defend herself. In other words, it will be suicide. And there's a reason the Jews are not so quick to concede. Start conceding land, start to concede this division of this peace plan. Because in their mind, militarily, they'll never be able to defend themselves. But here's what's on the horizon. When that is divided, when this prophecy comes true, what are the Jewish people going to do? Are they going to rely on Iron Dome? Are they going to rely on their tanks? Are they going to rely on flesh? Because we're told by Jeremiah, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength, but blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord. No, what they're going to do is they're going to invite their king back. Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. Lord Yeshua, help us. Israel, the Jewish people, are going to turn to the Jewish Messiah, and he is going to come. So there is hope in the future. He is going to come, and he will deliver them, and it will be over. But you got to understand where we're at in the signs and the times and how all of this plays out. And I know we still have questions. That doesn't mean, you know, after today we've answered all the questions. We still have questions. Well, how do you deal with the Antichrist? He's supposed to be in the temple, defiling the temple. What about the abomination of desolation? We have questions. We're going to get to those things, but not today.